Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. You know, the drill recording on Thursday morning. So because Vladimir Putin is giving his annual State of the Nation address today, Thursday morning, when we are actually taping the show, I decided I would grab Lynn Ekdahl's poem entitled Russian Nero. Vladimir Putin believes he's exalted. His rebuild of empire cannot be halted. He started out slowly, Abkhazia, Ossetia, small unknown places like little Transnistria. He bit off Crimea and Eastern Ukraine. Then his ambition became very plain. Though he started out slowly, one slice at a time. Now NATO is building a Maginot Line. His bombing in Ukraine is terror, of course. Killing innocents is the approach he endorses. He squashes opponents at home and abroad. Apparatchiks in Moscow just smile and applaud. He's a relic of empire, an empire fallen. He's a KGB thug and a wannabe Stalin. He arrests those who anti-war sentiments say, assassinates those who may get in his way. This devious, poisonous, treacherous Nero murdered an icon, a genuine hero. He poisoned Navalny, next to go after his wife. That's Vladimir Putin, dictator for life. Oof. Joining us right now is Scott Braddock. He's the editor of The Quorum Report, the voice of Texas, the dean of the Austin Press Corps. If it is Friday, it must be Texas. And of course, it must be Scott. Welcome back to the program, Mr. Braddock.
How are you?
I'm doing. I've got two people now on in hospice, so it's been a tough week. Hard to say goodbye.
It is tough, you know, to have that part of life play out. You know, you get different acts of life, right? You know, coming up in the world, and what are the different stages of the people that you knew? They get married, then they have babies, and then you hear about funerals. You hear about people going into hospice. You hear about the end of life care. It's all very emotional stuff. I am now coming to the end of the Texas primary. The end is in sight.
And if
I look a little exhausted, Arnie, if I sound a little weary, I've been all over Texas for the last 2 months trying to keep up with this. And then I'll tell you what happened. And then when I was in Abilene, Texas, 2 days ago, which is, they call it Abilene, and you know, the state has all these different regions that kind of have their own interesting names. Some are straightforward, like Southeast Texas, East Texas, West Texas, far west. There's West Texas, then there's far West Texas. So West Texas would be places like San Angelo and Lubbock, and Abilene is actually its own little thing. Abilene, they call it the big country there. Okay. And far West Texas would be Marfa, El Paso, places like that. They don't really consider themselves South Texas out there, even though they're on the border. South Texas would be down around Brownsville and Laredo and places like that. And Brownsville and Hidalgo County and Cameron County, they would say that that's, quote, the valley. So you got all these different places. Was in and none of those places are the place that I'm about to mention, which is the Panhandle. So I'm in North Texas today. I didn't mention that either. I'm in Dallas, Fort Worth, which is roughly the size of Massachusetts. Okay. Mm-hmm. And the Panhandle is about, I've driven to Amarillo, which is in the Panhandle. I've driven there from Dallas before. It takes about 6.5 hours to get to Amarillo from where I am in Dallas. And north of that, up into the far Panhandle, you have communities like Canadian. And people have seen on CNN, MSNBC, and their national newscasts, and online, people have seen this devastating wildfire that broke out.
Oh my God!
While I was in the big country a couple of days ago, and where again, everything is so big, it's 6 hours from here to Amarillo would be another hour to Canadian. So 7 hours up there, something like that. Where I was in the big country 2 days ago is 300 miles from where these fires are.
Okay.
And when I woke up yesterday, I walked out of my hotel and I had heard the reports about the fire up in the Panhandle, which again is 300 miles from where I was. I walked out of the hotel and I could smell burning. What is burning? And at first, brain didn't put the two things together. Something must be burning down the street. It was that thick. And it looked like cloud cover in Abilene, but it was smoke. And in fact, 500 miles away in El Paso, it had reduced the visibility out there in the air. So these are massive wildfires that are burning. A friend of mine who's from Ohio, who lives in Austin now, he said, "What?" And people don't have any experience with the, you know, when you get move out into the Western United States, you get these giant wildfires. And we have for a long time. I'm not going to sit here and tell you that climate change has not made it worse. Of course, it has. But my friend who's from Ohio, who has no experience with this at all, said, "Well, what, how do they put that out? What do they do?" And so this fire, as of I think on Wednesday night at about 11 p.m. Central Time, it was my understanding that it was burning at least about 1 million acres out there. That's about 100 miles across. It's about 100 miles from Canadian to Amarillo. And there are, if you look online now, there are complete neighborhood. The pictures are devastating. The complete neighborhoods that are just wiped out. Late on Wednesday night, we were hearing about people 100 miles from those communities in the city of Amarillo. People were leaving, just getting in their cars and starting to drive south to communities that are in sort of the lower panhandle area to try to get away from it. And I had heard from some folks who I know out there who were moving as quick as they could because the fire was 6 miles from the city limit of Amarillo, which is not a small, you know, it's smaller, but it's not a small town.
No.
And people are trying to get out of there. And again, my friend said, what do they do when a fire is that big and the conditions are that dry? I mean, they can try to put down fire breaks. They can keep putting water on it. You see the, you know, the overhead flights of them sort of like bombing it with water and with the, you know, with the fire retardant and all of that. But the real answer is, I told my friend, as I've seen lots of these, the real answer is God needs to show up.
Yeah, the weather.
It needs to rain, right?
The
It
weather.
needs to rain. And
Exactly.
so
God needs to show up.
so what you see this morning is, I mean, it couldn't be more dramatic, and the situations are terrible. We've already seen at least one death out there. Someone's not able to get away. We do expect for an inch of snow to fall on the panhandle where this fire is burning over the next 24 to 48 hours. So that will definitely slow things down and put it out. But you should, I mean, just look at the images online. It looks
It's incredible.
post-apocalyptic out there. It's just terrible. It's a horrible situation. And there's a disaster declaration about 60 counties out there, 6-0. But look, when you're in the Panhandle, West Texas, it's so big. I was talking to a young reporter who's based in D.C. earlier this week, who was asking about some of our legislative races, which you and I are going to talk about here in a little bit, I think. And this kid, I say kid, I'm the old man now, Arnie. This kid who's just out of college and he's covering politics in Washington. I did make the point. I always make this point to folks who are places like New England, the Eastern Seaboard, that people don't have any idea about how big Texas is.
Exactly.
Right. And so when you're in the panhandle or where I was in the big country, a lot of people, and this is, you know, this is something that would be something that you might think only rich people would do this, but there are middle class people in those places who have small airplanes. Because to get from one place to the next, it's all 2 hours, 3 hours, 4 hours away to go from Abilene to Lubbock on up to DFW or wherever. And one of the former state senators from Amarillo, who was also the mayor of Amarillo, Kel Seliger, the way he had to campaign out there was he had a small plane so he could take it from, he could fly it. I mean, he was the pilot. He would fly it from Amarillo out to some of the other communities that are that were represented, you know, included in his Senate district. His Senate district at the time, geographically, is as big as the state of Indiana.
Oh my God.
Right. And it's not,
Exactly.
and here's the thing, it's not even the biggest one.
Yeah.
It's not even the biggest of those districts. And so, you know, you get out there and you start to realize because you can, you know, drive between Houston, Dallas, and Austin, San Antonio, our more urban areas. But if people haven't been out there where there's just nothing for
Yeah.
hours and hours, they don't have any idea how big this is. And so I've been thinking about that in the context of the immigration debate, which we'll also get into a little bit. And all of this just fear mongering, whining, complaining. I've started to say in some of my speeches, Arnie, that when Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick or Governor Abbott, when they make this big deal about how, you know, we don't have, you know, we don't have the, you know, the room for all these people who are coming in, I think, are they on some different planet? If I get in my truck and drive to Marfa,
Yeah.
I can drive for 5 hours and not see another person. I mean, it's not like we don't have, now I get it. It takes resources to take care of people,
Right,
but you get my
infrastructure,
point.
everything else. I
But you
get your
get my
point.
point. It's
Yeah.
not as if it's the situation that they're describing in
Right, urban
Texas.
density.
Yeah, it's somewhere between the situation I'm describing and what they're saying. there is a reality that is not reflected at all by the rhetoric or the movie set that they have set up down on the border.
So what's Abbott doing? I mean, Abbott has so much on his plate with these fires. Is he present, or is he at the border with Trump and Biden, or is he worrying about school vouchers and trying to make sure that he has the primary results he's needing, or is he really serving the community that he supposedly is supposed to represent as governor?
A large swath of Texas is on fire, and you can see it from outer space.
Right.
And the governor will be today. We are recording the show Thursday. The governor will be, of course, with President Trump down on the border. And interesting, you have Biden and Trump in Texas here on the same day, about 5 hours from each other.
Yeah.
Biden in Brownsville on the border. He had made it a point. All these people keep saying, "Why does?" And here's the thing for Democrats, it's such a no-win situation on the border. It always is. And here you have Biden, who's finally going to go down to the border, where these people have been saying, for months, if not the entire time, you know, for years, the entire time he's been president, all these same people saying he needs to go to the border and check it out himself. He needs to go to the border. He goes to the border and they say, well, it's too late. It's too late to do anything. Was it the same thing when Obama was there and he was known on, you know, among some folks on the left as the deporter in chief at that point?
Yes, I know.
Obama had deported more people than any president up to that point. And of course, that still wasn't enough for, you know, those in the right wing of the Republican Party who would say that he was for open borders.
Well, I'm looking at an article from The Hill that just from this morning, the Democratic National Committee is putting up billboards in Eagle Pass for Trump's border trip. And I've been banging the drum about putting up billboards. And apparently they're putting up a billboard that plays videos attacking Trump and his immigration record for his hand in killing the bipartisan border deal. So even though Biden won't be there, the billboard will be there to welcome Trump. So I just thought that was kind of interesting.
On that border deal, I saw where Biden put on a video either on TikTok or Twitter or whatever, where they had, you know, Biden is shown, you know, Republican, he's looking at an iPad and he's watching the responses from Republicans about the way things went down with the border deal. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he points out that Republicans just admit, Trump admits, and Speaker Johnson essentially admits it, and Congressman Troy Nels from here in Texas. Troy Nels, who's a former sheriff in Fort Bend County down near Houston, Republican congressman, who said Biden's approval ratings are so low, why would we help him by passing a border deal? In other words, just admitting that it's all about politics.
Exactly.
I still wonder, and I'm going to bring this up again, Arnie, we've talked about it a little bit on your show. I still wonder whether Democrats will be able to keep that going, you know, through the rest of the year, to be able to point out to people that, hey, while the Republicans are complaining about the situation on the border, they had every chance to pass what was a pretty conservative piece of legislation. That was
right.
Not anything that liberals were asking for. You know, that was a clampdown on asylum seekers. You know, that's a big part of that piece of legislation. I saw that Governor Abbott was on CNN, I think on Sunday morning. And I think he was talking to Dana Bash over there, who does such a nice job. And she asked Governor Abbott about what President Biden has talked about. After the border deal didn't pass, you have Biden talking about doing what he can administratively to tighten things up about asylum seeking. And Abbott didn't, you know, the governor Abbott didn't want to answer that question. So what he did on the TV show was what I thought I heard you say is basically he wants to let people come on in here and we shouldn't be letting them do that. And he kind of danced around with all this. Pretty bizarre moment, you know, yeah. from these folks who are twisting themselves into pretzels to do nothing productive about immigration and the border.
Expect
to do
except
that, to do
ex,
nothing
except,
that would be helpful.
Expect except spend billions of Texas tax revenues to do nothing.
Yeah, that is.
Let's remember, that's the part that really kills me, is that it's not like he's not draining the coffers of Texas in order to strengthen the border, when here is the federal government prepared to sign into law something that will actually do something. So instead, he supports the do nothing as he then turns to Texas and says, give me more money.
$12 billion so far spent. Over the last 6 years or so to quote unquote secure one city park in Eagle Pass, Texas. I think that's where Trump and Abbott will be today.
It's kind of shocking. So let's talk a little bit about this primary that you've been bouncing around the state of Texas. What's happening? What do you think the results are? Is there pushback against people like Abbott, against people like Dan Patrick? I know that there's an assault on Phelan. There's an assault on many of the House members, in part because of what they did with Ken Paxton, but also because of the voucher bill. So I'm just trying to figure out who's on first, who's on second, and what do you predict?
It's pretty wild. So when I was in Abilene, as I mentioned a couple of days ago, it was because Governor Abbott was coming through town to support his candidate and hold a rally for her. This is a woman named Liz Case. And I love Texas politics, Arnie. There are moments when I get so worn out with it. There are moments I get so worn out with it, and then things happen like I'm about to tell you. So I go to Abilene, and when I arrive there, and I was there about a month ago. Because this is one of the priority races that I've been looking at. You have an incumbent Republican and very conservative member of the Texas House. His name is Stan Lambert. He was a banker out in Abilene for about in Abilene and Dallas for about 40 years. And he's been called sort of a cautious conservative, if you will. He's somebody who's an old school Republican. He would be one of those Ronald Reagan type of guys. And I will say, just a nice man. And he's facing the onslaught from Governor Abbott endorsing his opponent. Former President Trump has now endorsed his opponent.
Oh,
This is
jeez.
unpre this is crazy.
Crazy. It's
I was talking to
crazy.
some of the leaders in Abilene. I mean, people like former mayors, city council people, school board members, and old school Republicans, some of the what we would call the red coats, which are in Texas is the TFRW is the Texas Federation of Republican Women. Who you usually don't, and they're the ones who show up with, at the convention. They've got the red sequin jackets on, right? These are
I
the
love
ladies in the
it.
Republican Party you don't want to piss off.
Yes, I
So
got it.
I'm talking to people like that, and they were saying, this is insane. This is unprecedented. You have never seen anything like this in human history, where a former president inserts himself into a local race out in the big country in Abilene, Texas. And he did this in several Texas House races. This is just a good example. So when I got to Abilene a couple of days ago, I saw yard signs that people can see on my Twitter. Just go search at Scott Braddock and scroll through the photos. Really remarkable. There's a yard sign that has all these faces on it. It's got the face of Liz Case, who is the GOP challenger to Stan Lambert. Next to her face is Donald Trump's face. Next to his face is Dan Patrick, our lieutenant governor's face.
I
Next
knew
to his
that.
face is Greg Abbott, and Ted Cruz is also on that thing.
Oh,
There are all
Jesus.
these faces on this, and even one of the supporters of the incumbent, Stan Lambert, said that on election night they're going to go out there and grab one of those signs just for posterity, because that's never going to happen again, right? That's completely crazy. So you get to watch Abbott speak to about 300 people in Abilene, Texas, and outside of his event, there was you just don't see this. Republicans protesting each other. There were about 150 supporters of Stan Lambert outside the event with Stan Lambert signs and signs that said things like no to school vouchers, support public education. I was told that the governor changed the time of the event because he heard there were going to be protesters and he didn't, he wanted
Avoid
to,
them.
well, he would not just avoid them. He moved the time of the event up by about an hour. It was supposed to be at 4:30 p.m. He moved it up to about 3:30 because he didn't want teachers from the Abilene Independent School District showing
Oh my
outside. So,
God. Oh my, it's right there out of school at 4:30.
and get this, because the challenger who Abbott is supporting, because she still takes her homestead exemption in Dallas, where I am today, you can see this on my Twitter as well. The supporters of the anti-voucher Republican, they had a loudspeaker at outside the Abbott event. They were playing the theme song to the old TV show Dallas. They were
Oh
making
no,
fun of
which
the
is where
fact that this
homestead
woman is from
exemption
Dallas.
is.
So as Abbott's deal was wrapping up, as his event was wrapping up, I went to just about a half a mile away. There was an event for Lambert, and this is a guy who, as I say, he's just sort of a normal guy. He's not a charismatic speaker, or some politician who's ever
He's a
going to be,
banker. Come on, he's a banker.
he's never going to be the governor. He's never going to be the U.S. Senator or anything like that. He's a banker, and I think he's 73 years old. Anyway, this is not somebody who gets emotional in public. He was almost crying because he had about 200 people show up for his event, at the cool little venue, the Grace Museum in Abilene, Texas. a nice little event space. And I mean, these are people who are just doing their best, Arnie. They brought in, you know, pizza for everybody to have like a little party, and they had a guy playing a guitar and that sort of stuff. But he did give this speech, and I tweeted out some videos from this, and I've been doing this. If people scroll through my Twitter over the past 6 weeks or so, and you look at the videos and the pictures, you can see what's going on. And I need to put them all in a book somewhere, or in some kind of a presentation. The pictures and then the videos, you could put something online, put it all together in some kind of a presentation. People could check it out. What's been going on is remarkable. I told you last week about an event where 400 people showed up to support the candidate that Abbott's been attacking. Everyone it's I'm talking about is a Republican. 200 people in Abilene this week. And Lambert, the representative for the area, he got emotional as he was talking about, you know, the fact that, look, he agrees with Governor Abbott on the vast majority of issues, probably almost in lockstep. And the way he's described it is to say, but we're on different paths about this school voucher thing. Yeah. A guy like Lambert knows, and he gave an incredible answer on a radio show earlier this week about why he's against school vouchers. And he's a banker, he's a finance guy. And so he understands what would happen if he started to take money out of the public school system. He knows what would happen to the Abilene School District. Mm-hmm. He knows what would happen to the other school districts that are in his district. He has a few of those rural districts that would just be decimated by this, you know, over the long haul. And he said, we need to send a message. He's telling his supporters there at this event, we need to send the message that this house is not for sale. You have all these people who are coming in from out of state, the Betsy DeVos folks, and Betsy DeVos, the Amway, you know, billionaire heiress, married into the Amway fortune, of course. She has said, you know, these are private school, these are, you know, private school business folks. She has said the reason that they're spending so much money to try to push these school choice, parental empowerment, and school voucher things in different states, it's because their family wants a return on their investment.
Yes.
Business thing.
Business venture.
When I have gone around the state talking to Republican voters who see that their state representatives as Republicans who voted against vouchers, they see that those folks are under attack in a way that is really dishonest and unprecedented. Because there's so much money, and the attacks, Arnie, it's different. They're not in any way tethered to reality. I remember even two and 4 years ago, the vast majority of political attacks, there would be some kernel of truth to it. In this cycle, the people who voted, just like every other Republican in the Texas House and Senate, voted on border issues, including supporting Governor Abbott and that $12 billion and also voting to allow for police in the state to deport people. Those who voted against vouchers, though, are being attacked on TV and in mail pieces as being what? As being soft on the border. There was one TV ad that ran against Lambert and Dwayne Burns and some of these other guys that would put the state representative's face on the screen. It would say, "This is Stan Lambert. He said he would shut down the border, but it's still open." And then they show the border and people coming in. This ad is being run by a group that's doing what? Trying to push school vouchers.
Right.
Their issue isn't even the border, but they're attacking these folks because they know that that's what's going to work.
Because that's the vulnerability place.
That's what's motivating the Republican base. And I would say that I've been a little frustrated with, you know, my colleagues in the media here who continue to say, and there have been, you know, some national stories about the Republican primary that's playing out in Texas. You've seen some national headlines that say the Texas Republicans are eating their own, you know, they're you know, at war with each other. And I hear people in the media say, and I see it in print, that this is the most contentious Republican primary ever. Well, no, I have covered Republican primaries in Texas for a long time. They've been contentious. They've been nasty. I think back to 2016 and 2018, where incumbent Republicans under the speaker at that time, who was Joe Strauss in the Texas House, that, you know, Republicans would be accused of, you know, wanting to kill Down syndrome babies. And there's a billboard I think is still up from 2016 or 18 against a guy who's not even in the Texas House anymore that said that this guy wants to kill Down syndrome babies. It's been contentious before. And that was also dishonest. This is not the most contentious Republican primary that I've seen. It's the most dishonest one.
Well,
contentious and dishonest are not interchangeable terms.
They're not.
People need to understand it. The lies that are coming from these third party groups, and here's what gives it more credibility to the lies. The governor himself the most popular Republican, not just in Texas, but right now he's a very popular Republican around the country, Greg Abbott, calling people who voted with him 99% of the time, he's calling them liars and frauds. He says he doesn't trust them on any issue. He's been tweeting this stuff out, Donald Trump style. And I think the damage that he's doing to the legislative process, to his own party, it will take years to recover. He won't be in office anymore by the time that the damage can be healed.
This is so, I'm exhausted just listening to you. If it is Friday, it must be Scott Braddock. He is the editor of the Quorum Report, the voice of Texas, the dean of the Austin Press Corps. And yes, everyone, contentious and dishonest are not the same words. They cannot be used interchangeably. Thank you so much for reminding me of that. Anyway, have a good week and good luck with this primary. When is it over? 2 days from now?
We have the Texas primary, Super Tuesday. It all happens at the same
time. Super Tuesday, okay.
On March 5th, and we'll see where we go from there.
All right. Take care. Thank you so much. This is the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. Stick around, folks. We will be right back.
Let's reflect for a minute on the recent remarks of Supreme Court Justice Elena Kagan.
Listen up. This matters. I'm Lewis Black, and this is the Civil Liberties Minute with ACLU attorney Bill Newman.
Justice Kagan, during a public conversation at the Library of Congress, avoided saying anything directly relevant to any case before the court. But she did articulate decision-making principles and powerfully shared her perspective on the court discarding precedent. Justice Kagan said, "When the law flip-flops after change in personnel on the court, it doesn't look like law anymore. It looks like a form of politics." She continued, "And I think that's especially important for this Supreme Court at this time. Law should not look like a form of politics, where just because the composition of the court changes, a whole batch of legal rules change with it." Justice Kagan added, "When what was once a right is no longer a right because the court is different, I think that's very damaging to the court, very damaging to society." Justice Kagan did not mention any one of the dozens of examples where this Supreme Court has reversed or dramatically changed longstanding law, but as Adam Liptak wrote in the New York Times, it was a good bet that the court's 2022 decision overruling Roe versus Wade was among one of the ones on her mind. And let us add, ours too.
The Civil Liberties Minute is made possible by the American Civil Liberties Union, because freedom...
When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933. When your eyes are open, when you know the history. When your parents lived through things that looked so much like this. All the indications impossible to miss. When you've sought for your whole life to make the earth a better place. And you once again see the rising of the master race. When you know that they are coming, when they announced it in advance. When you know for many people this will be their last chance. Then you may ask the question, what can one person do? When the time to act is now, and now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933. When indefinite detention is the new reality for so many children to whom you did not give birth. When you see they're just as precious as every other child on earth. When they're opening the camps, not used since the war, where families were imprisoned decades before. When Kristallnacht is coming, they announced it on the news. When the writing's on the wall, when you can see the fuse, then you may ask the question, what can one person do when the time to act is now, and now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933. When you know rallies are not helping and silence is complicity. When you know where the kids are kept locked inside their cells. When you see approaching the future this foretells. When they're coming for your neighbors. When they've even said what day they plan to put them all in buses and take them away. When you know where they keep the buses. You've been to the parking lot. Perhaps a whole lot of petrol bombs is the best move that you got. Then you may ask the question, what can one person do when the time to act is now? And now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933.
Of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. We continue to record on Thursday morning. So let me explain that this is normally a day that we bring Bill Curry on every week. And Bill Curry's partner died last week. So he is taking some time off, which he so well deserves. I can understand the despair. And I was just saying to Scott Braddock, who is always on right before him, that this week I'm spending time with two people who are in hospice. So I feel like that's what I'm on. I'm going from one hospice to another home hospice, and it's emotionally exhausting. But stepping in for Monsieur Curie is Stephen Pimper. He is a senior fellow at the Carsey School of Public Policy at the University of New Hampshire. He's the author of four books, including his most recent book, Politics for Social Workers, A Practical Guide to Effecting Change. It received the 2023 Best Book Award from the Society for Social Work and Research. Thank you so much for doing this, Mr. Pimper.
Happy to be here, Arnie.
And Dave Leventhal, he leads Raw Stories Newsroom as editor-in-chief and oversees its investigations and enterprise reporting. He is based in Washington, D.C., so he's close to the power and the rot, and that's my words. Dave previously worked as deputy editor and senior Washington correspondent for Insider. He's also worked as an editor and reporter at the Center for Public Integrity, Politico, Open Secrets, the Dallas Morning News, and, of course, the Eagle Tribune, which is where I first met Mr. Leventhal many, many decades ago. Welcome back to the program, Dave.
And it is great to be back with you, Arnie.
It's a pleasure. So I asked Stephen, where do you want to start? And of course, I'm not shocked. I'm so disappointed. I'm so sad because now the Supreme Court is sort of aiding and abetting what we saw happen on January 6th. They're now, I think, almost an extension, Stephen Pimper, of the insurrection. And the article out of The Hill was entitled, Supreme Court Agrees to Weigh Trump's Criminal Immunity in Historic Case. I am angry. I am frustrated. This is going to be such a challenging election. And the Supreme Court once again has weighed in not to support democracy, not to embrace the Constitution, but to aid and abet Donald Trump. So what are your thoughts? It's a very sad time.
I was actually a little shocked. And maybe this is one of those rare instances in which I thought John Roberts' instincts to work to preserve what legitimacy the court has left would prevail. I think this is one of those instances in which process is important to remind folks of. Remember that Jack Smith and the DOJ went to the court in December and asked it to hear this immunity claim on an expedited basis in order to keep that trial for the insurrection on track. The court declined. That gave us a two-month delay while the circuit court heard arguments, wrote a decision. One Bush appointee and two Biden appointees unanimously agreed that there was absolutely no legitimacy to the claim. That was then appealed to the court 2 weeks ago. And that delay has caused people who pay attention to the court say, huh, what's going on? This should be relatively quick for them to decide. The assumption that I was making and many others was that they were going to deny cert, to not agree to hear the case and let the trial go forward, but that, you know, Thomas or Alito or some combination were writing a dissent and that was what was taking the time. It would appear that that's not what was taking the time. And as you suggested, one thing that one might conclude is that they are aiding and abetting Trump's efforts to not be held accountable for his actions. It was clear in listening to the arguments about the 14th Amendment Section 3 case, right, which was Colorado's assertion that they could remove him from the primary ballot because he had engaged in insurrection. Listening to that oral argument, they're going to ignore the plain text of the 14th Amendment and allow an insurrectionist to remain on the ballot and possibly regain power. And it would seem working very hard to ensure that the federal court system is also unable to hold him unaccountable. It is utterly appalling, and another instance in which everyone who thinks that the court is illegitimate and corrupt is correct, and we need to reinforce that and start to ask questions about why nine wizards in robes get to decide whether we are a democracy and whether we have rights.
I want to remind everyone that the three-judge appeals panel wrote the most amazing, unanimous decision. There was not one word that they didn't all three agree on, which is so, so rare. And what they said was that the former President Trump lacked any lawful discretionary authority to defy federal criminal law, and he is answerable in court for his conduct. That's what they said. All right. They basically, and everyone who read the decision, Dave, were first of all, they were so impressed that they gripped arms together and that they worked together and that they spent this time, and it was so thorough and so complete and so clear on its face that it was even hard to imagine that you could find any kind of wiggle room. And then to find out 2 weeks later, it took them 2 weeks to drag their knuckles and then do this. You know what they understand. Trump's friend isn't winning. Trump's friend, David, is delay. That is his friend, because that has worked for him over and over again. So in a funny way, it gives the court kind of cover, some fig leaf. And at the same time, it aids and abets Trump, because he doesn't want a decision. He wants a delay. And that's what makes this so, so disgusting. But as I'm thinking about this Supreme Court, I immediately think of who? I think of Mitch McConnell. And Mitch McConnell's decision now to step down as leader. And of course, he says his greatest contribution was the court. Well, this is the same frickin' court that is now destroying democracy, aiding and abetting someone who wants to be a fascist and has actually destroyed the Republican Party. So the court he delivered is actually now destroyed the thing he claims to have loved. Oh, David, it is just, it's a horrible tale, but it's one we all are now being forced to live, David.
Oh, I'm glad there's not a lot to unpack there, Arnie.
Yeah.
The concept of delay, the idea of delay and that being Donald Trump's great friend, entirely true. Now, yeah. One kind of counterbeat to that is that Donald Trump cannot delay everything. There are four separate criminal cases that are pending right now, running parallel to the 2024 election. They are all interrelated in the sense that, of course, they involve Donald Trump, but also that their own individual schedules are contingent to a very significant degree on the others. So if one is delayed, well, not all of them are going to be delayed. And we're going to see, for example, the trial in New York. That's on a fast track right now. That likely could be happening very, very soon. Now, whether the cases in Georgia and Florida are also going to further be delayed remains to be seen. But justice is going to be coming to Donald Trump's doorstep very, very soon. Not in a matter of months, but really in a matter of weeks, barring something completely unforeseen at this point.
I mean, the criminal stuff is one thing. You know it's killing him. What's killing him is the $454.2 million judgment, where all he's able so far to be able to post is a bond of $100 million, and he's asking, you know, the judge to, I mean, the money is what defines him. Money is what crushes him. The loss of money is what actually puts him into despair. So all these things that are happening from the criminal front are things he understands he actually can use delay. This is what must be absolutely wearing him apart.
Oh, the money aspect he's apoplectic.
He's apoplectic.
Beside himself. This is literally the currency of his existence. And as a result, he's a very unhappy Donald Trump in that respect right now. But the criminal cases are the ones that can actually put him behind bars or can detain him in Mar-a-Lago or something where he is not going to be a free man. And anyone that I've ever talked to on the Republican side of the aisle and pose the question to, what does Donald Trump truly fear? The loss of his freedom is something that he truly fears. And I guess in that way, he's like everyone else, if he's not like everyone else in any other way. So that's something that has consequences that are tangible, consequences that are severe as anything. Although I should note too, that it might not in and of itself, him being behind bars or otherwise detained, would prevent him from continuing to run for president. And I'd like to go back just for a second to offer what is probably not the majority analysis here, something that might be unpopular to the ears of some of your listeners. But by this going to the Supreme Court, I do think that there is a scenario here. You can agree or you can disagree, but there is at least a scenario where the Supreme Court, when it ultimately rules on this matter, is going to vote 7-2 or 8-1 or even 9-0, in which case the strength of the decision is going to be enhanced even to basically to the highest level possible. So the delay of grave concern to so many. The delay, very frustrating to so many who want to see justice come to Donald Trump in the moment. But when we look at the longer arc of history and the notion of, is a president of the United States, be it Donald Trump or the next Donald Trump to come 30 years from now or 100 years from now, do they have presidential immunity in the way that Donald Trump thinks that he does? If the answer comes back from the Supreme Court as no, that in a historical context holds that much more weight to the decision that's going to be made than that of a circuit court.
So Stephen Pimper, Dave is talking about the arc of history. I'm not sure we have an arc anymore. My problem is that we always look through this historical lens, Stephen, as if there's a future, as if there's a potential for change. And I'm looking at this and I understand that rationale, Dave. I've heard that rationale. They could take the case. They could hear the case and then 2 days later make a decision. They did that in Florida. You know, with Gore, I mean, they how quickly did they sprint to make a decision on Gore v. Bush? All right. But they won't do that. That's my fear. And the idea of this arc of history. Am I crazy here, Stephen? I don't think that we have time. I don't think we have time. I keep talking about the urgency of the moment. And the urgency now is just, it's getting more and more frightening because, you know, I thought the urgency was going to be what happened in Ukraine. I thought the urgency was going to be about the climate crisis. I thought the urgency was going to be about the pandemic. I thought the urgency was going to be about the economy. I thought the urgency was even going to be about democracy. But now I feel like the urgency now has multiplied on every single front. And I don't know how you operate in such a short period of time and expect people to be able to make a rational decision. You just heard what Scott Braddock said. He said there's a primary going on in Texas. They call it contentious. He says it's not. It's dishonest. And that is the word going forward between now and November. This is not about a contentious election. This is about a dishonest one, Stephen.
So I'll say first that I think that Dave's hypothesis is absolutely plausible, right? This is John Roberts saying this is too important an issue to have the final word left to a circuit court, and we have to take this case in order to rule. However, the cynic in me wonders if whether there are, it took four votes to agree to hear this, right? Are there five votes to craft a Trump-specific decision, as they did remember in Bush v. Gore, right? They explicitly said in Bush v. Gore, oh, by the way, this doesn't apply to any other set of circumstances ever in the past or the future. This is only for this election so our guy can get in. And remember, two sitting Supreme Court justices were actually part of Bush's team that litigated Bush v. Gore. Right. So this is a very long history of a deeply corrupt and profoundly politicized court. I mean, I want to go back to McConnell and sort of his role in this and how we think about his legacy as he's right stepping down from leadership. But it's not said whether he's leaving the Senate or not. I think he's got 2 years left.
He's got two years left. He says he's not leaving. He says he's going to sit there.
You know, if you make a short list of the figures that have done the most damage to U.S. politics over the last 30, 40 years, I mean, off the top of my head, my nominees are going to be Newt Gingrich, Donald Trump, and Mitch McConnell, right? Because what Mitch McConnell has done has successfully taken U.S. institutions that already fight against majority rule in favor of minority power and has solidified those and ensured that even in a minority in the Senate can effectively stop the majority from exerting its will. His successes have actually been in the things that he has not done. Right. So he famously, when Obama won the election, he said that our number one job is to make sure that he is a one-term president. Right. Not, you know, we need to enact all kinds of policies and we can only do that if we get rid of them. No, the goal was politics without policy. Right. And proceeded to do that, obviously not allowing the nomination of Garland to even get a hearing. Right. Is another example of that. It is. And the big one, not convicting Trump.
Yes.
In the second impeachment after the January 6th, right? We wouldn't have to be, our brains would not be filled with Donald Trump had Mitch McConnell put his money where his mouth was and whipped votes and ensured that Trump was convicted, by the Senate and then unable to hold office in the future. He has got a lot to answer to.
So, Dave, why don't you bring up money, though?
Yeah.
If I could just jump in, Arnie, to say, yeah. Funny you bring up money, Stephen, because Mitch McConnell, and I think this is underappreciated and in public discourse, is the singular most important force against campaign finance reform
100%.
Any form. Yep. And as a result, I mean, we've talked about a dozen different issues in the 20 minutes here, and all of them, every single one of them, to some extent or another, has a money element to them, a money dimension to them, a political money dimension to them. And Mitch McConnell, had he wanted to allow certain types of reforms to go forward, to Citizens United, I think, is, of course, the granddaddy of them all over the past 14 years, but on any level, to try to rein in the influence of money as it affects the courts, as it affects the legislature, as it affects the executive branch. You could go on and on. We could have a whole segment on this. And the bottom line is that Mitch McConnell, time and time again, stood in the way of those reforms. So when we talk about any of these issues, you have to talk about the money element. And Mitch McConnell is absolutely a central character to all of that.
And Dave, I you wanted to talk about one of the sort of themes in Raw Story about the neo-Nazis. And I want to actually connect the dots. How Mitch, this is a title of a piece from Vox, how Mitch McConnell lost by winning. He delivered for the old GOP, but the party has changed underneath him. And the party, you know, was always sort of on the verge of being fascist and white Christian nationalists and sort of, you know, playing with dictators and despots. But I would love to sort of bring in your neo-Nazi story and Donald Trump and white Christian nationalists and the proliferation of all that rot that now actually are the feeders to what is now the GOP. I mean, in so many ways. And this is what Mitch McConnell did. He aided and abetted that, you know, with the money, as you point out, with the Supreme Court, with the abusive process, with the requirement for supermajorities, with all these things. What did he do? Is there any great policy you can point to? No, but you can point to all the underlying rot, and he is at the center of it, Dave. It's unbelievable.
So one of our themes of coverage at Raw Story this year, Arnie, is the intersection of politics and extremism, which when you say that, people immediately, their minds spring to January 6th and what happened during the insurrection and the attack on the U.S. Capitol. But we've tried to go a layer or two or five deeper to really explore the underbelly of extremism in this country that people rarely see. Everyone vaguely understands that it's a thing. You hear the term neo-Nazi or white nationalist or whatever it may be, and you think bad things, but can anyone really define it as it exists today in 2024? And we're attempting to do that. So I would just point out that if I could make a shameless plug for a series that we published last week, the headline of the lead story, a three-part series, is Inside the Neo-Nazi Hate Network, Grooming Children for a Race War. Not talking about adults here. We're talking about 17-year-olds. We're talking about kids who are in high school. We're talking about kids who, when Donald Trump became president of the United States in 2017, were in fifth grade. And look, I've been around for 25 years doing journalism. And as an editor or a reporter, this is one of the most profoundly affecting stories that I've ever been a part of. The author, Jordan Green, has done this work at considerable risk to himself. He wrote a first-person article defining and detailing what that risk actually was, which included six neo-Nazis coming to his house in Greensboro, North Carolina, with flaming torches. And so this is what we're dealing with right now, not just in the act of journalism and doing this work, but that everyone in the country in their own backyard likely has some sort of an element not too far by that's very much under the surface that needs to be outed. And
but this it's not going to be outed, Dave. Let me just Right. I sent you a piece that came out of Iowa. And let me just say something, Stephen. So we're talking about grooming youth, okay? And now we're talking about the neo-Nazis that you're hearing David Leventhal talk about, and the white Christian nationalism and the resegregation of schools. So what is the underpinning of that, Steve? The underpinning is vouchers. The underpinning is vouchers. And what we know is that if you want to create a neo-Nazi private school, Dave Leventhal, you now get public dollars, Stephen, in order to support that thing. There was an article that came out about, you know, bringing chaplains into public schools, and the Satanic Temple can't wait because they're going to offer up their satanic chaplains to public schools. We have no idea how distorted and the kind of rot that is now being invited in. As you hear that story about young neo-Nazis, please understand they're still in school, Stephen. Then the question is, how do you use a voucher to ultimately aid and support the white Christian nationalist neo-Nazi agenda? Now you actually pay with public dollars for them to be taught, Mr. Pimper.
And this, you know, in some ways goes back to the segregation academies after Brown versus Board of Education, right? The establishment of private schools in the South to avoid having to segregate. Now it's you know, when 60 years later are successfully filling the public trough for that money. I think it's also useful to think about the extent to which there have always been neo-Nazis, white supremacists, at the fringes of the party, that, you know, they've always been at CPAC, the Conservative Political Action Committee, which held its meeting this past week. But typically they have not been welcomed in. And this year they were welcomed in, right? So it's both the normalization of it and the failure of sort of more mainstream media outlets, no disrespect to Raw Story, but folks that have a much larger audience, like, you know, the Times and the Post and network television. You know, one might think that you could pay as much attention to this as you do, I don't know, the citation practices of the president of Harvard University. It is so utterly, I mean, this is more evidence that every single one of our institutions right now, it feels, is absolutely failing at this utterly crucial moment where so much hinges on what's going to happen over the course of this year. And it is so frustrating to see people with power and influence consistently focusing on the wrong things. Well, so, you know, that's the argument. Make me editor of the New York Times.
There was an article back a couple of years ago that is just so relevant today. It was written in 2018, and it was a study done by Pew, and it said that most wealthy countries aren't religious, but then there's the US. And now, again, understanding how we have now bastardized religion. I mean, we have. And we're using this as an excuse for the vouchers, as an excuse for money and politics. And what they said was, why is the U.S. so interesting? Because the grotesque inequality that also is in existence in the United States. And that as a result of this inequality, you do see this rise of religiosity. And then you look at the states where there's the greatest, you know, wealth inequality, and they're the most religious. So in an incredible way, what the wealthy have done with their investment in buying and selling politicians, with their investment in buying and selling lobbyists, with their investment to make sure that the vast majority of tax cuts goes to the wealthy and not to the rest of us, with the idea that we don't have access to healthcare. I mean, David, what they have done with this inequality is actually invite all the rot that you are seeing. And, you know, Pew was looking at inequality as an excuse for religiosity. I'm looking at it as the excuse for everything that is now going to undermine our ability to be a democracy going forward, even though I even question whether we're a democracy right now. It's just going to get worse, David.
And I know we only have seconds left, but I would just say, I think the great question here is, what are the Democrats going to do about it and during 2024? And how are they going to not only respond, but offer a brighter future and a brighter path forward? This is no endorsement of any political party, far be it from me to do so. But I think as a question that as reporters, we're going to be asking again and again is, what's your response? And I don't know if the Democrats have a cogent response quite yet to that, but we've got many months between November, now in November, and that's
and this is the Friday edition of The Attitude. We've been talking with Stephen Pimpera, senior fellow at the Carsey School of Public Policy. We've also been talking with Dave Leventhal, who leads Raw Stories Newsroom as editor-in-chief and oversees its investigations and enterprise reporting. I recommend that you check out their piece about the neo-Nazis. Anyway, gentlemen, thank you so much for doing this. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Arnie.
Ciao. This is the Friday edition. We will schmooze on Monday. Ciao. You better think about what you're trying to do to me. Think, let your mind go, let yourself be free. Let's go back, let's go way on, way back when. I didn't even know you couldn't have been too much more than tame.